from the heart of the Forest City, this is a Craig Needles podcast brought to you by Lexus of London. Now here's your host, Craig Needles.
The Craig Needles podcast on a post-election Tuesday morning here at ClassicRock981.com and LondonNewsToday.ca, brought to you by our friends over at Lexus of London. And I want to talk about a few different things and narratives that we saw emerge from the results last night. I want to talk about how long it took us to get results last night. But I first want to talk about what I think is the biggest story here. And the biggest story with last night, not just in London, but all over the province, voter turnout and lack thereof. In London, for example, 75% roughly of people who were eligible to cast a ballot did not do so. So why did that happen and what do we do about it? Kate Graham joins us here on the Craig Needles podcast to talk about that. You know, Kate, she's a political scientist. She's been a candidate before and I wanted to chat with her about this because she was tweeting about it. And I said, yeah, we need to talk about this. So Kate, thank you very much for doing it. We appreciate it.
Well, thanks for the invitation. Yeah, this is what we need to be talking about today. So thanks for having me on.
I'm just going to go through a few Ontario cities and you tell me sort of what your reaction is to some of these numbers, because I just rounded these and I tweeted this out. Ottawa, 44%. Okay, sure. Hamilton, 35. Windsor, 32. Barrie, 30. Toronto, 29. And we keep going down here. London, 25. Mississauga, 22. Kitchener, 20. Oshawa, 18. Some pretty ugly numbers there. How do we get to this point, do you think?
If I had the answer to that, I'd be writing a book on this right now. But I do think it is it's cause for alarm bells to be going off. I'm not sure what the right number is where, you know, once we hit that, we call the government that it elects, you know, representative, and that, you know, it's a sign that people believe in government, they believe in politics and so on. But the numbers coming out last night, similar to what you just relayed, you know, kind of community by community, as we were looking at those turnout scores at the top, it just felt overwhelmingly like a message that for most people, you know, this municipal election, and this is true in the last provincial election and so on, but for a lot of people, it just doesn't feel relevant or important or meaningful enough to take the few moments that it takes to get out and vote. So, you know, in a place like London, where 3 in 4 people decided yesterday, and in the, you know, advanced polls and so on leading up to it, that it wasn't important enough to participate. Like, we need to pay attention to that. We need to listen to that and try to understand why that is and what we can do about it.
I wish I knew too, because I just, for me, and I know I'm a dork, I love elections and I love the political aspect of it. Yeah, but there are some people that it just, they don't feel like it impacts their lives, even though it does. And they don't feel like they need to go and vote, which no one has to go do anything. But why do you not feel like you want to go do that? It's not that much effort. A lot of municipalities have introduced online voting to varying degrees of success. So there are conversations about how to make this easier and how to make this more accessible. But clearly we haven't made it accessible enough.
Well, so the responses about how do we get turnout up often kind of fall into two categories. So the first would be, you know, something along the lines of, if only voting was easier, if people could vote online or more hours, or, you know, the election fell on Diwali, which is obviously a problem. And like, all of that is true. Making voting easier is important, but I haven't seen much evidence. This is a studied question that suggests that making it easier to vote is what drives turnout up. The second kind of category of response is, well, it's the candidate's fault. You know, they weren't exciting enough or dramatic enough or whatever. And I also don't really buy that. You know, we're talking about a group of people who, at great personal cost in every sense, you know, put their absolute heart and soul into trying to connect with people in the most on the ground way, you know, knocking on doors, talking to people one by one. And so laying it at the feet of the candidate saying, well, if only they were better, you know, something would change. And I don't think that's true. In fact, I think we actually have this big mismatch between candidates who, for free and at great expense, you know, put this time into engaging people, and an electorate that just generally isn't listening. My gut feel on this is that the problem is actually the system itself. You know, we have designed a political system that's supposed to represent people, and it's supposed to be an opportunity for people to come together and shape decisions that affect all of us. And when it doesn't feel like that is working, or when it doesn't feel like it's producing outcomes that people can believe in, when it doesn't produce governments that look like the people it's supposed to serve, all of those things sort of erode people's faith in this thing that we call politics and our political institution. So for me, the problem is the system itself. And when we see that it's not working, having a willingness to say, well, this is not the only way that this could be designed. Maybe there are things that we should change. So yes, I want to see it be easier to vote. Yes, it's great when we've got, you know, phenomenal charismatic candidates. And I think we certainly have, you know, there's lots of examples of those all across the province. But for me, this is a bigger, deeper problem about, do we trust our systems of government, and do we find them meaningful enough to our lives that it's something we want to participate in? And if the answer is no, it needs to cause a really deep reflection on, okay, then what do we do now?
Maybe it's not necessarily a reflection on the candidates as people, but perhaps instead it's more of a reflection on the candidates and what they're talking about, and maybe what they're discussing, what they're proposing doesn't impact people's lives the way that perhaps we would want it to. Do you think that's a possibility?
I mean, I think it could be. I mean, the traditional, the sort of conventional wisdom, and I tweeted a bit about this this morning, is that a really hot race is the thing that gets turnout up. And in particular, when there's an open mayoral seat, and when there's a interesting race, that's when people feel like their vote actually matters and the stakes are high enough to get out and vote. And looking across, I'm just starting to pull the data on this, but where there were open seats at the mayor level and where there weren't, where the races were tight and where they weren't, it doesn't seem like that is enough. Like there's sort of slight noticeable differences, but I don't think that tells the whole story about what's going on here. And again, I think we need to look more broadly at, we have had three elections in 13 months. We did have a pandemic. People are tired. People are overwhelmed. I think there are kind of deeper challenges we need to pay attention to here, rather than just saying, well, wouldn't it be great if the candidates knocked on more doors? Because lots of that has been happening, and it doesn't seem to be translating into turnout happening. And that's true across levels of government.
Yeah, I don't know either, because, yeah, there was definitely lots of doors knocked on here in London. I will say, from a London-specific example, there was an open mayor's seat, but, like, it wasn't that open, you know what I mean? Like, it felt like we pretty much knew who was going to win the whole time.
Yeah, I think this is the sort of analysis that's needed now, is looking at races where it was really tight for mayor. So in Ottawa and Hamilton and Vaughan, there are a few places where it was really, you know, you're sort of refreshing and sometimes the results are changing. In those kinds of races, that would be traditionally where we would expect to see the highest turnout. And when people expect that it's going to be a tight race, that's where we see them turning in bigger numbers. And I would agree with you that I don't think that was the general sense in London. So maybe that's a part of the story. But, you know, of the large municipalities in Ontario, like London had the largest drop in our turnout, 14%. And yep. Maybe it's because we moved backwards from ranked ballots into first past the post. Maybe it's you know, something else. But again, things that this is sort of morning after or day after reflections, but really important indicators that we need to be paying attention to.
I wonder as well about people being electioned out. This is the third one of these we've done in 13 months.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that would be the sole factor, but that maybe this is just a combination of factors thing, and that's one of them.
Yeah. I don't know about you, but the people who are most involved, I'm like the media, it's very demanding.
Yes.
The pool of volunteers, the people who are running campaigns, the pool of donors, candidates draw on the people around them, but there is a group of people who are very involved in every election. And it is a lot to be asking them, to come out for a third election campaign in such a short time, and layered, of course, on top of what's been a really taxing couple of years for people. So, yeah, it's definitely part of the story.
What do you think candidates might be able to do in order to not necessarily convince more people to go to the polls? Because I think that's, like you said, it's a layered thing. It's not necessarily on candidates, but to get people more interested in these races. Or do you think maybe it's a lack of media coverage of these races when it comes to council races, municipal races, the way that the media has changed over the years, or just isn't as much coverage of that as there used to be? I think there's a whole bunch of different things we have to examine here.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, as you say, like probably a lot of factors. I can't help but kind of think back to, like, I was knocking on doors yesterday trying to pull the vote for, candidates I was supporting, thinking to the provincial election and the last federal election. You have these conversations repeatedly at the door where you're standing in front of someone, talking to them about the issues, trying to tailor it to exactly what matters to them. Being sort of as personal as possible about their own life and why this election is consequential. And many, many, many times having the response be, well, you know, I don't know, it's been like a busy day, or I'm just not sure that I'm going to go vote, or, well, it doesn't really matter, or, you know, I don't think that, you know, whoever gets in, it's all going to be the same. Those kinds of sentiment, when you hear it over and over and over again, Again, I think it speaks to a much deeper problem. Like, turnout is sort of the symptom, but I don't think it's the disease. And, I do hope that, you know, candidates do a lot of work, and we should give enormous thanks to candidates and their teams, those who won and those who lost, for putting heart and soul into having those conversations every single day over the last several months. But at a deeper level, I'm not sure that we have a system that people believe in anymore. And the system, to me, it's not the people in the system that are the problem, it's the system itself. And if we want to see things like turnout going up, if we want to address the symptom, we need to be prepared to start getting at the underlying disease. And if it's a political system that's fundamentally not producing governments and issues and ideas that people can believe in, that's the thing that we need to be talking about, even though it's nebulous and tricky. I think that's the real problem that these numbers are pointing our eyes towards.
Yeah, you mentioned mistrust of government systems, and that can come in all different political ideologies of having no political ideology at all, far left, far right, all sorts of different things in between. And I wonder, because you'll get far right as an example, like the convoy types, PPC types. Yeah, they have mistrust of government systems, but they are still showing up to vote in a lot of cases. So it's not something that is just impacting one particular part of the political spectrum, I don't think. I think it's a pretty wide-ranging thing where people just, for whatever reason, don't feel they want to participate. And that to me may be the most disturbing part, is it's something that's impacting so many people, you don't even know where to begin as far as trying to find a way to fix the problem.
Yeah, and I think that's exactly the tricky part. You know, the world has changed very quickly. Like, the way that we express ideas, the ways that we get information, the way that we connect with one another, all of those things have totally transformed in the last couple of decades. But our sort of clunky systems of government have not. And again, I'm speaking to this more as like a question and an observer, somebody the day after the election thinking, what on earth is going on here and where have we lost our way? Here to try to, pitch a decisive answer, but, where people, the way that they want to engage in politics, where they're not finding a system that allows them to do that or invites them to do that, and maybe even turns them off so profoundly that they're totally disinterested and checked out. I think that's the real heart of it. And as I said, I hope that this is like a moment in time where we take a quick minute and start thinking about what we do about that and having more intentional conversations about that rather than just kind of the details of each race.
Yeah, because people aren't going to want to be lectured. Well, why didn't you go vote? You're not
exactly
doing your civic. Like, that's not going to help anything, right?
No. And do we blame? I talked about the conversation on doorstep with someone saying, oh, I've had a long day. And you look at the person on the other side, if you've had this experience, and you think, you probably have had a long day, and your kids need you right now, and your work is demanding, and you're tired, and you need groceries and whatever. And like, blaming people for not engaging doesn't help anything. And I think also is a bit of a misread on what the problem is. If it is so taxing and so onerous to participate, or if it feels so irrelevant, and it could be a combination of those things, then the forms of political participation need to change. We need to be open to different ways of hearing from people about what matters to them. And that's something I think there isn't a lot of space for right now in the way that we engage in politics and the kind of decision-making systems that we've built.
Yeah, it's a big problem, and what do you do to attack it, and where do you begin? So last thing I'll ask you before we go is Ottawa, 44%. Some people are going to say, oh, what are they doing differently in Ottawa? Am I right, or am I being overly simplistic if I were to say, hey, Ottawa's a political town because that's where people who work in politics go to live, so therefore they're always going to have higher voter turnout? Do you think I'm being overly simplistic, or do you think that kind of explains why they were up at 44?
Well, I mean, turnout in Ottawa is usually higher. It was also considerably higher than the average in the last election where they had an incumbent mayor running. So, maybe it's just that it is a political town. Maybe it's the dynamics of this race. They're one of the few places where turnout went up between these two elections. So I'm not sure. But yeah, it's definitely an important case for us to look at.
Yeah, it's interesting. Anything else, Kate, that you wanted to make sure folks know about or weigh in on the voter turnout front and how we engage people better front before you wrap up here?
Well, I think so. And this is just speaking as like a citizen, as a Londoner, as somebody who I'm sure is not alone in this city, and looking at the results last night, and being thankful for the people who ran and optimistic about a new council, but also quite worried about a moment in time where, you know, such a huge portion of the community decided that this wasn't important enough to participate in and want to have a discussion about what else political engagement can look like. You know, there are kind of interesting things happening around the world about how we engage and empower citizens, you know, things like, you know, these are sort of viewed as being kind of fringe ideas, but like sortition, like randomly selecting people to be able to work on particular public policy problems or deliberative processes or, you know, changing the way between elections that we're connecting with people about the things that matter to them. And, you know, I say this with great respect and admiration, but for all the folks who were elected yesterday, you know, it is a part of London's story now after that kind of a drop in turnout to say, okay, we've got some work to do on building the kind of local governance that people want to be a part of, and maybe inviting, you know, average Londoners to share their thoughts on what exactly they could look like and what issues are important to them and how they want to be engaged in those things. So again, with my sort of optimistic and hopeful Londoner lens on, I hope that this is a moment in our city where we say, okay, we've got this new council. We know that the issues that they're going to be working on are important. And we also know that we need to find new ways to engage people in talking about their local government. And we've got 4 years to do that. It doesn't just have to be an election time thing. So that's my optimistic view on last night and my hope for the next 4 years.
Yeah, well, like I said, and I think this applies to people who were elected and people who were not elected. You got 4 years to get people to be,
exactly,
you know, interested in this and want to be have some level of involvement in the next municipal election. So we'll see what happens. But yeah, it's definitely interesting and sort of a sad tale when you look at the numbers. Kate, thank you so much for this. I'm glad you're able to spend a few minutes chatting with me. You had some things you wanted to share, so I'm glad we could do that in the podcast today.
Anytime. And thanks so much. I don't think we say it enough, but thanks to you and your media colleagues. I know elections are really demanding. And I also, once again, just want to say a thanks to everybody who put their name forward, successful or not, and the teams around them that supported them. It's a huge undertaking, and our city is better for it. So really appreciate all the work you do.
Thanks, Kate.
Take care.
That's Kate Graham, who, of course, political scientist over at Western King's College. That's Kate Graham, political scientist, joining us here on the Craig Needles podcast. Now, I do want to remind you that the Craig Needles podcast is brought to you by our friends over at Lexus of London. Lifestyle with a drive. Your new Lexus is patiently waiting for you. The award-winning Lexus of London, 1065 Warncliffe Road South, and online at lexusoflondon.com. Now, I have a couple other election thoughts I want to share. First, results, quickly, through all the wards, and I tweeted this out earlier, but let's talk about it right here. For starters, there were some non-surprises last night in London's 14 wards. Go through the non-surprises. It was not a surprise that Sean Lewis, Corinne Rahman, Steve Lehman, Anna Hopkins, Paul Van Meerbergen, and Elizabeth Pelosa had relatively easy nights. Not that people didn't run good campaigns against them, but we all knew those would be very difficult incumbents to beat, and they did not get beaten. In fact, they won by relatively sizable margins. Slight surprises. I'm not surprised at all that Peter Cuddy won Ward 3. Not surprised at all that Jerry Pribble won Ward 5. However, I did think those races would be tighter. I really did think that. Good for those guys, though, for getting their voters to the polls and going out and winning. Hadley McAllister, in Ward 1, defeating an incumbent, Michael Van Holst. I was not surprised at all by that. The only question in that ward was, would the votes for Hadley, the ones, of course, that wanted Michael Van Holst to not be their councillor there anymore, would those votes, the anti-Van Holst votes, coalesce behind McAllister? Once we got the advance polls and saw that McAllister was well ahead of any of the non-Van Holst candidates, I think I knew right then and there it was going to be over. Because Van Holst needed a large vote split in order to be the councillor who finished at the top of the rankings in Ward 1. Ward 4, similar thing, only the vote split happened. Susan Stevenson would have not been the preferred second choice of most of the Jared Fisher voters or the Colleen Murphy voters or the Matt Nicolaitis voters. However, she still won with less than 29% of the vote. Suboptimal, bad system. Doesn't mean, however, that Stevenson is somehow an illegitimate counselor. She got the most votes. She wins. That's it. It's over. Ward 14, I thought Sarah Lehman had a real chance going into last night, and she made it real close. Lost by about 250 votes to Steve Hillier. When you go up against an incumbent counselor and you kind of enter the race late in the game like Lehman did, even making it close, I think is kind of a win. I think if the race is a little bit longer, she could have won, but it wasn't. Lesson there, I think, and this goes to anyone who's thinking about running 4 years from now, get your ducks in a row early. If you want to go after an incumbent, good, you register in May. That's when you register. You do it in May. Surprises, or things that I didn't quite see coming. I didn't think that Sam Trasso was going to win Ward 6. I thought it was going to be very, very close, but I thought that Mariam Hamou was going to have a slight edge. Trasso wins by a couple hundred votes. That was not the way I thought it was going to go. I wasn't shocked by that at all. I thought it was going to be really, really close. So really, there wasn't going to be a result that would shock me, no matter what, unless someone won by a big number. And that clearly is not what happened. The big surprise of that. Oh, Ward 11, by the way. I was a little bit surprised by the margin. Skylar Frank ran just a really good campaign. Really, really good campaign. It was tight. It was professional. She did a great job. And she won because of those things. And it was a campaign where experienced people were working on it. And I think that really matters. So good for Skylar Frank there. Jeremy McCall was not at work. Jeremy McCall worked really, really hard. But sometimes there's a difference in politics between working really, really hard and working in a way that's super efficient. I'm not saying that Jeremy was inefficient. All I'm saying is Skylar sort of had really experienced people on her team. And I think that wound up making a difference. Or at the very least, that was why I think that the split between the two was so large. Put it that way. Ward 13 was the big surprise of the night for me. David Ferreira winning over John Fife Miller. That was the big surprise for me. Not because I didn't... If it was just David Ferreira and John Fife Miller straight up, it wouldn't have necessarily shocked me. But I thought that John Fife Miller would win with a relatively similar number of votes to what he got. I just thought that David Milley and David Ferreira, the two Davids, would split the vote a little bit more than they did. But a lot of people, including people in my neighborhood who had Milley lawn signs switching to Ferreira, that was what told me that, hey, wait a minute, this maybe is going to be a closer contest than you thought, Craig. Because I walk in Ward 13 a lot. I live in Ward 13. I know what's going on in the ward. I thought John Fife Miller was going to win. But the trick that John has is very, very, very popular with downtown business owners. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's a good thing. I think that councillors should want that. Trouble is those downtown business owners, they vote in wards like 8 and 7 and 5. In a lot of cases, they don't vote in Ward 13. And I think that showed up on election night. Mayor's race, massive landslide. That's what everyone thought was going to happen. It's what did happen. I talked about the tight, professional, and smart campaign that Skylar Frank went. Josh Morgan did the very same thing, had just an all-star team of people supporting him, people that you've heard on this podcast, who I think very highly of because of their campaign skills. And those campaign skills came to the forefront when Josh Morgan won by a very significant vote. I saw some people saying, well, he only got 15% of the vote if you account for the people that didn't show up. So how much of a mandate could he possibly have? I will say this. The person who finished second got 5%. You could make the 75% of the electorate who did not show up to vote yesterday, you could make them go to the polls tomorrow. Tell them they get $10,000 to go to the polls tomorrow. Just vote for who you want. Josh Morgan still wins. So do we need to do more to get more people to the polls? Yes, absolutely. Do we need to do more to get more people interested in levels of government that impact their lives greatly? Yes, of course. Is Josh Morgan's win somehow delegitimized or not as good because people didn't show up? No, I don't think so. I think it's very clear who the people of the city wanted to be their mayor based on the candidates that were available. Now, if you were to say to me, hey, Craig, there was not a serious campaign to go up against Josh's, and that is the disappointing part of this race, we would agree. We would be on the same page there. And look, if Josh Morgan winds up being the mayor, if he runs against whoever else, yeah, maybe, probably, sure. But it's better for the city if we could have had several campaigns with several different sets of ideas going up against each other, as opposed to what we had here, which it kind of just felt like a one campaign show, right? So there's that. Last thing on the election. Last thing on the election before we wrap up here. Do we have to re-examine the way we vote? And I would think that the answer is yeah. Maybe we do need to vote online. I'm going to read to you something I got from the City of London. And I asked, hey, wait a minute, why were we voting way, way, way behind are counting way, way, way behind other municipalities in the province. Last night, as an example, by the time we had counted 30,000 votes in London, Toronto had counted 340,000 for just John Tory. By the time Toronto had counted 1,400 polls, we had counted 80-something. Just, it was an embarrassing performance by the people who are running our election last night when it came to the speed of the counting. And there were some races that weren't called until 11 or 11:30, whatever it was. And that, again, I think that's embarrassing. Just about every other municipality is able to do this in a more expedient manner than we are. Why is our result creation such a problem? This is what I got from City Hall when I asked, hey, wait, why did it take so long? This is from Paddy McKeag, who's in comms at the City of London. The last tabulator with election results and ballot box was received at City Hall at roughly 10 p.m. City of London deploys 191 election day tabulators across the city to enable paper ballot voting and physically uploads results from each of these locations when the tabulators and ballots are returned. The memory cards were removed from the tabulators and delivered to a central location for verification and upload. This verification process ensures accurate reporting of unofficial results. We can confirm there were no major issues in polls closing and reporting back to City Hall on election night. There were some municipalities in the surrounding area that use online voting, which would have shortened the time for results. All right, then why can't we use online voting? And do you really expect me to believe, and I've asked follow-ups on this, but do you, City of London, really expect me to believe that this is just regular counting? Maybe we should just, other places have online voting. Why was Toronto counting at a rate that, what, 20 times as fast as you were? Why did we know who the mayor of Brampton was going to be before we had any idea which members of London City Council have been elected? Patrick Brown was called at like 8:20 or something. It was early. John Tory, same thing. I don't understand what the problem is. And I'm going to keep asking about it. And I'm going to bug them until they tell me, because that's unacceptable. And most people are just going to forget that last night took forever. That's not something that's going to be on people's minds until 4 years from now when it takes forever again. But this keeps happening here. This keeps happening here. And I would like to know why our counting system is so different from other Ontario municipalities that are doing the same stuff we're doing. This goes back to 2010. In the 2010 election, I remember not knowing the result of the Ward 9 race between Gina Barber and Dale Henderson until the next morning. We hadn't started counting at all, and Rob Ford had already been declared mayor of Toronto. So this is a regular problem for us. This is something that happens way too frequently. Way too frequently. So, what do we do now? Well, we are going to continue to ask questions, and we're going to hope that more people decide to show up and go to the ballot box. And we're going to sign off the Craig Needles podcast. Thank you very much for listening to this edition of the podcast, which is brought to you by our friends over at Lexus of London, Lifestyle with the Drive. Your new Lexus is patiently waiting at the award-winning Lexus of London. Luxury defined. You can find them at 1065 Warrencliffe Road South and online at lexusoflondon.com. You can find more of this podcast at classicrock981.com and londonnewstoday.ca. We'll be back on Friday for an all-council edition of the Friday Roundtable. Hope you can listen to that one.
The Craig Needles Podcast is a presentation of the Blackburn Media Podcast Network.